Chapter 19. A Partner in the Process. Creation is not an act, but a process. It did not happen 5 or 6,000 years ago, but is going on before our eyes. Man is not compelled to be a mere spectator. He may become an assistant, a collaborator, a partner in the process of creation. Theodosius Dobzhansky, Changing Man. In the last decade, Rosemary and Peter have witnessed two of the most extreme years of the century in these islands, the wettest and the driest. In the wettest, more rain fell in a single day than falls in a normal wet year. In the driest, not a single drop of rain fell. As Peter says, you can't get a drier year than that. At any other time, the flood and the drought would have been seen as acts of God or freaks of nature. But today, when the Grants think about those Malthusian years, they wonder. The idea that organisms evolve was transformed during the last century from conjecture to fact, they write in Noticias de Galapagos, the journal of the Charles Darwin Research Station. As the present century draws to a close, we are experiencing another transformation. The conjecture that the world's temperature is gradually rising has become widely accepted as a demonstrated fact. Most Earth scientists now agree that during the last 100 years, the planet's surface temperature has risen, with hesitations and reversals, by about 0.5 degrees centigrade. This now notorious global warming began around the time of Darwin's death in the 1880s, and it became strongly marked by the close of the 1980s, which was, as the Grants write, undoubtedly the warmest decade of the century. Meanwhile, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has also risen, with fewer hesitations and no reversals. Other gases have accumulated too. All of them are byproducts of human industry and agriculture. Carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and nitric oxide are billowing invisibly from our fires, smokestacks, and exhaust pipes. Methane from our vast fields of cattle, sheep, and rice. The gases trap heat, which is why they are called greenhouse gases, and most Earth scientists expect them to trap more and more heat in this century. The forecasts are highly uncertain. The crystal ball is cloudy. Nevertheless, the Grants write, we should be thinking about the implications of global warming for Galapagos. Global warming is of special interest here because in these islands the round of the seasons is driven by ocean currents. Half the year the archipelago is bathed in cool waters, the other half in warm. The cool waters come from the south equatorial current, and the warm waters from the north equatorial current. The difference between these currents is often 10 degrees centigrade, sometimes as much as 20 degrees, which is more than enough to bring distinct seasons to the islands. If it were not for these alternating currents, the islands would have no seasons at all, since they lie exactly on the equator. Nor would they carry their bizarre flora and fauna. It is because they are a meeting place of waters from north and south that the passenger list of the islands is so diverse, including not only tropical lizards but also fur seals, not only tropical flamingos but also penguins, the only penguins on the equator. A warming of even 0.5 degrees centigrade can cause a change in global circulation patterns and make trade winds and ocean currents veer away on new tracks. Because they depend on winds and currents for their very seasons, the Galapagos Islands are particularly vulnerable to changes like these. That is why the Finch watchers on Daphne Major always put quotes around the word typical when they describe a typical wet season or dry season. The currents are so variable that no 2 years are alike. What is more, the Galapagos lie near one of the key pressure points in the global circulation system, the birthplace of El Niño. The arrival of El Niño every few years has the effect of heightening and lengthening the contrast between the warm bath and the cool bath. Though no 2 years are alike, the Niño years are more different than the others. Each Niño turns life upside down, coming and going. If the winds and currents, and hence the seasons, were not so variable, the Galapagos finches would not need such variable beaks. Indeed, it must have been a freak of these variable currents that first swept the finches to the islands. These winds and currents helped make Darwin's finches what they are, and they are still shaping the finches today. It is no exaggeration to say that a lasting change in the ocean currents, especially a change in the intensity or the frequency of El Niño, would change the course of evolution in Darwin's Islands. And the islands sit in a spot where even a slight global warming could make an enormous and early difference. A few years ago, when they got back from Daphne and began their annual catch-up with the world's news, Rosemary and Peter were interested to read a short article that had appeared in the journal Science. The article was written by a climatologist at the U.S. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, Andrew Bakun, who described the implications of his study as uncertain but potentially dramatic. If present thinking about global warming is correct, Bakun argued, and Earth's atmosphere is growing warmer, then the surface of the planet should be responding unequally. The land areas should be warming faster than the sea. In the seas, cold water is always being churned up from below. If the continents are warming faster than the seas around them, Bakun reasoned, then the contrast in temperature between coastal lands and coastal waters should be increasing. One consequence might be an acceleration of offshore winds, because such winds are driven precisely by this difference in temperature between the coastland and the sea. Bakun collected wind stress records for the northern and southern coasts of Peru, and also for California, the Iberian Peninsula, and Morocco. He found that along every one of these coastlines, wind stress has risen significantly since mid-century. The waters off Peru, the birthplace of El Niño, present an extreme case, according to Bakun. In the middle of this extreme case, of course, sit the Galapagos Islands. So the freak weather the Grants have seen in the past 10 years may have been something more than chance. It may, just possibly, have been influenced by global warming. And if so, it may be only the beginning. In The Origin, Darwin asks readers to imagine, hypothetically, the case of a country undergoing some slight physical change, for instance, of climate. If the country were part of a continent, its borders might be flooded with immigrants, Darwin writes, with endless trains of evolutionary consequences. Even on a lonely island, the inhabitants would adapt to the altered conditions, and natural selection would have free scope for the work of improvement. No islands are too remote for these experiments, not even the Galapagos. In fact, with Darwin's Islands, once again nature seems to have arranged a particularly dramatic case, a demonstration of the power of slight physical changes to push Darwin's process in surprising directions. A rise in global temperature of 0.5 degrees centigrade is probably less than what Darwin has in mind when he speaks in this passage of a slight physical change. A rise in carbon dioxide concentration of 1 part per million per year might have seemed to Darwin almost too slight to consider, too small to propel his process. But changes even as small as these can propagate through Earth's climate system and through Darwin's web of complex relations until they literally change the face of the world. The Grants' argument about the fission or fusion of Darwin's finches, for instance, depends on the island's climate staying more or less as they have seen it in the last 20 years. That is, when they project the fate of Darwin's finches, Rosemary and Peter have always assumed there will be no net change in the seasonal cycle of the archipelago. They have assumed that the pendulum of ocean currents will go on swinging annually but erratically between wet seasons and dry seasons. But this is no longer a safe assumption, the Grants write. Global warming alters the argument. If global warming did give birth to the wild child of 1982, then more warming, if it comes, may well bring more Niños like that one. The Niño of 1982 has often been described as the strongest of the last century. Some climatologists now believe it was the strongest of many centuries, perhaps the strongest in the second half of the last millennium. Before that flood year on Daphne Major, Darwinian selection was keeping Darwin's finches apart and distinct. After the flood, selection pressures on Daphne began forcing the birds together. If global warming does bring more extreme Niños, then the selection pressures on the islands may take a very long time to return to what they were before the flood, The conditions on the islands may not return to what they were for many decades, the Grants speculate. Perhaps a century, in which the prospect of three species fusing into a single population becomes more likely. The small, medium, and large ground finches, those bicycle pump productions, are extraordinarily responsive to changes in the weather of the islands. If Niños were to begin to come harder and faster in this century, then it would take only about 200 years for the finches to fuse together and undo all the evolutionary work that has carved them apart. On the other hand, it might not take Darwin's process very long to separate the birds again, to turn a group of Fuliginosa into a Fortis, or a Fortis into a Magnerostris. Trevor Price has calculated that it would take about 20 selection events as intense as the drought of 1977 to turn a Fortis into a Magnerostris. And if the starting point were not Daphne but one of the islands where Fortis is larger, then the change would take only a dozen droughts. Trevor worked out that in a relatively small time you could get from A to B, says Peter Grant. I hadn't, when we started this work, even thought that would be possible. In other words, in the present climate of the Galapagos, it would take only 1,000 years of not unlikely weather to create a new species of Darwin's finches on the islands. And if the climate were to change and inflict a series of grim droughts or floods at just the right intervals without missing a beat, it could create a new species in a single century. For the moment, the link between Galapagos weather and global warming remains speculative. But the case suggests the kinds of Rube Goldberg-like and ultimately unpredictable local events that global warming may inflict in our lifetimes, even on some of the most isolated islands in the world. And our power to drive Darwin's process, like the power of the process itself, is not hypothetical. The Industrial Revolution was changing environments and, with them, the course of evolution even before Darwin published The Origin. That is the message of the single best-known evolution watch in history. In 1848, a lepidopterist in Manchester by the name of R.S. Eddleston put a pin through a moth, a rare form of the species Biston betularia. The normal form of the moth was whitish in color, with a peppering of fine black lines and spots. But Eddleston's specimen was almost as black as coal, from which it got its scientific name, Carbonaria. Collections feed on rarities. In the second half of Darwin's century, the black moth was prized by every butterfly and moth hunter in the British Isles. It was so ardently sought after that evolutionists in our century have been able to use Victorian lepidopterists' records and collections to trace the spread of the black mutant across England. In 1860, a specimen of Carbonaria was netted in Cheshire, in 1861 in Yorkshire, in 1870 in Westmoreland, in 1878 in Staffordshire, in 1897 in London. Soon after the first sighting, the black mutant became more common in each of these places until the white form at last grew rarer than the black.